governance law, current customer, sorry, well, the last one. Why don't we? Coat off, scarf off, bag down. We're talking about bank payments, various slightly confusing to and fro cases in which banks are sometimes held to be liable in relation to processing checks they shouldn't have done, perhaps when there's an obvious forgery on them, and situations in which the customer may be held responsible for that. Okay? So that's been our big focus hitherto. We've got to 2.7 on page 102. We get to the question of mistake. And the old decision of Barclays Bank and Sims, I say old 1980, Mr. Justice Gough. And this is the principle, as set out by his lordship. We can do no better, I think, than start with Mr. Justice Gough. What happens if there's a mistake in permitting a payment by a bank through someone's account, for example, on presentation of a cheque or under another payment instruction? If a person pays money to another under a mistake of fact which causes him to make payment, he is prima facie entitled to recover it as money paid under a mistake of fact. Okay. The basic principle, if under a mistake of fact you make a payment, then you can get it back. We'll come on to West Deutsche Landes Bank in a second, but that's on the basis that common law of money had and received. Or if you're Professor Peter Burks, you would say it's on the basis of unjust enrichment. Yes. Very good. And this is before we get to Clymer Benson and Lincoln City Council, where, if you recall from doing contract law, we're now able to recover money on mistakes of law as well. Okay? But back in 1980, it was only mistakes of fact. Two, his claim may, however, fail if A, the payer intends that the payee shall have the money at all events, okay, so no matter what, whether the fact be true or false, or is deemed in law so to intend, or B, the payment is made for good consideration, in particular if the money is paid to discharge and does discharge a debt owed to the payee, or a principal on whose behalf he's authorised to receive the payment, by the payer or by a third party by whom he is authorised to discharge the debt, or the payee has changed his position in good faith, or is deemed in law to have done so. The general proposition, you're entitled to get a payment back if you've made a mistake, except for those circumstances. Now, I suppose I should put, Clymer Benson, Lincoln City Council there as well, you're entitled to recover on the basis of mistakes of law as well. The position, I think, is set out most clearly in West Deutsche Landesbank and Islington. It's such a neat set of facts. It's a shame nobody did the numbering, the paragraphs 1, 2, 3, like Mr. Justice Gough. West Deutsche Landesbank and Islington, if you recall, I may have mentioned it at some point in the last 2 years. Thank you. Interest rate swap. Yeah, we can all sing it together. West Deutsche Landesbank enters into interest rate swap with Islington, London Borough. It's a 10-year interest rate swap. About 5 years in, the parties realise, because of other litigation, Hazel against Hammersmith and Fulham, that the interest rate swap with a local authority, bless you, is void ab initio. Yeah? Void as though it had never happened. Now, bless you, the disease. It's not entirely clear on the facts of West Deutsche Landesbank and Islington on what basis recovery of the money is being sought. If you're Peter Burks, and Lord Millett's given lectures subsequently asking what's going on, is this about mistake? Or is this about failure of consideration? So are we seeking recovery on the basis that we were mistaken as to whether or not this interest rate swap was valid? Because before Clymer Benson and Lincoln City Council, we still couldn't recover on the basis of mistakes of law. Or is it a mistake of fact? Or is it because the contract has failed, we're relying on failure of consideration? So that is why Barclays Bank and Sims I still think is useful, because it's far more clear about the basis of recovery. But in West Deutsche, there is clearly a mistake, there is also a failed contract, therefore failure of consideration. And therefore, West Deutsche is trying to recover its money. Because it wanted compound interest, following on from Barclays and Sims and all these cases, it was accepted it would be entitled to get the amount back. The question, could it get compound or simple interest? The law at the time said you only get compound interest on your money if you can show you have a proprietary right in the fund on which that compound interest will be paid. Therefore, Westdeutsche has to try and show a proprietary right in the money. Okay. If Islington had gone into insolvency, it would have been exactly the same issue. You would have needed to show a proprietary right in the money that had been paid over to Islington. Okay. As we know, as we discussed before, there is no resulting trust over this money because resulting trusts arise in only two limited circumstances, not including this, thus dispatching Peter Birx's big argument that we should have a huge theory of a restitutionary resulting trust that reverses unjust enrichments across the board. That's rejected by the House of Lords. There can't be a constructive trust because at the time Islington received the money and spent it. It didn't know that it had received the money under a mistake. So its conscience wasn't affected. Ergo, no constructive trust. Also, all the money had been spent, the bank account had gone to zero, and therefore there could be no tracing into that bank account. Could we trace onwards from that bank account? No, because we didn't know where the money had gone. It had gone on general expenses. We couldn't identify any particular asset. So what does Westdeutsche get? Everyone accepts they're entitled to something. They get money had and received. This is the common law remedy, if you recall. We talked about this weeks and weeks ago. This is a common law remedy that says while you have no proprietary right to any particular fund of money, you are entitled to be paid on a personal claim an amount equal to the money you paid over in the first place mistakenly. So Westdeutsche paid about 1.5 million and they were therefore entitled to a cheque for 1.5 million. They just didn't have any proprietary rights in any particular money. So they were lucky that Islington was still solvent. They were unlucky that because they had no proprietary right, they only got simple interest on their judgment. Okay. So money had and received is what we call that claim. In Westdeutsche itself, Lord Gough suggests we call it a personal claim in restitution. He says it better describes what it means. It's restitutionary, and it's a personal as opposed to a proprietary claim. But it's always been known historically as money had and received. Okay, so that's the last little area of that. Just to kind of cap that off for things we've been talking about, mistaken payments. That's the basis on which you're entitled to get your money back generally, if there's been a mistake of that sort. We're going to come on to payment methods. This is now chapter 31, a different chapter in the book. We're not going to do payment methods in detail. Chapter 31 talks about how we've moved on from bartering chickens for bread, yeah, into a world in which we had money. Money which historically was actually worth intrinsically its face value. So gold coins were made of gold back in the day. Yeah. Silver coins were made of silver. This is why it was an offence to be a money clipper. Because what people used to do is try and shave bits of metal off coins. If you got a tiny bit off lots of different coins, you could then put them all together, melt them down, and create a brand new coin. If literally it was meant to be the amount of silver. That's why you see in those old pirate films, the first thing they do is bite the coin. You know, and you think, what the heck does a pirate do? Biting the coin. They're trying to see, by dint of biting it, whether it's silver rather than something else. Of course, you can tell that from biting. But that's what people are doing with expecting the coins, because, of course, coins were then minted by, you know, particular dukes, particular kings, particular areas, had their own coinage. So the only way of making it transferable and valuable is if it was intrinsically made of gold or silver or whatever it may be. Okay. So when we get into the early 18th century, okay, early 1700s, we start to move away from an idea of having coins made out of precious metal into coins being made out of base metal. Yeah. So very biblical this one, base metal. And also for the first time in the early 18th century, starting to talk about paper money. Yeah. This is a huge change. Good old days, if you wanted bread, you had to hand over half a chicken. You know, that was the price of bread. You bartered for it, yes?
Nowadays we need barter for sex, you know.
See if you're awake. I'll take you out to dinner with them. We move on to paper money, and this is a huge confidence trick. Very necessary confidence trick for how we work today. It was in France this happens first. A guy called John Laws goes to France and says, why don't you, to raise money, French king, instead of needing all this gold that has to be handed out in coin, why don't you issue banknotes in paper and say, people of France, you can buy and sell things with these paper notes, these francs, and on them it will say, I promise to pay the bearer on demand an equivalent amount of gold should you ever need it. Yeah? It's a big confidence trick in that people had to be convinced they didn't need gold anymore. All they needed to do was these intrinsically worthless pieces of paper. But because they had a face value on them, and they had the signature of the king's cashier, whatever else, to say, if you ever actually need the gold, I'll give you the gold in exchange for the banknote, people slowly started to be weaned off the need for gold and silver coins. Yeah? Huge confidence trick, very important. And it's how securities markets really started as well. Because people were also starting to buy shares in the companies that were beginning to be formed. The Bank of England was created in 1694. It's a similar kind of period, a bit earlier, in England, obviously. And there was another bank created in the early 18th century called the Sword Blade Bank, which is why I keep using the name Sword Blade Bank in some of the problem questions or whatever else, which was far more successful than the Bank of England. And what the Sword Blade Bank was created to do, amongst other things, was to help raise money to fight wars. Okay. This is what the Bank of England was created in 1694, to raise money to pay for all the wars we've been fighting against the French. Yeah. That's why we had the Bank of England. A lot of those of you studying revenue law probably talked about how taxes were raised in this jurisdiction mainly to pay for wars. That's the whole point. We didn't have income tax or whatever else for centuries. Instead, you just used to go and raise taxes to be able to go fight somebody. Yeah? We need money off people. That's all we used to raise taxes for. Bank of England created to wage war. Fantastic, isn't it? You know, all these institutions, they're all about blood, ultimately. Now, we get to 1720, and we created something called the South Sea Company in this jurisdiction. A guy called John Blunt borrowed the idea from the French that we could move away from needing things to be in gold and silver, and we could move towards an idea of people giving up also money that they're owed by the government. Because one of the ways of raising money to fight a war is that you tax people. The other way is that you get them to lend money to the government, and the government issues bonds. Yeah, we still have government bond markets today. Quantitative easing, as we'll talk about in sessions to come, is all about government bonds. So we're still doing the same basic thing today. There was a lottery in the UK, in England, I beg your pardon, at the time, whereby if you bought into the government debt, you also bought tickets to a lottery at the same time. By buying government bonds, your reward was you had the chance of winning prizes. Yeah? It's the national lottery in the early 18th century. Again, this is to encourage people to invest and to raise money for wars. We get a new king, a Hanoverian king, I've got that right, German king, imported because we were running out of Protestant monarchs, and he had no friends here. People were going to be less inclined to fund his wars. So clever John Blunt said, what you need is more people to invest. What you need also is people to agree that they won't make you pay back the money you owe them under these bonds you've issued. So we set up the South Sea Company. The South Sea Company is to go and do business in the South Seas, what we now call South America, where people believed that there was gold lying around on the ground. Yeah. You turned up with a ship full of sheepskins or something, you'd be able to exchange that for all the gold you could fit in the boat. That was the basic theory. Yeah. Problem was that people were idiots. Yes. We'd get past all the dragons, we'd get to the South Seas, money, gold lying around on the ground, we'll give people bits of bacon and a couple of sheepskins and we'll help ourselves. Yeah. Mad. Anyway. So the South Sea Company was formed to trade in the South Seas. And huge numbers of people, agreed to exchange their government bonds for shares in the South Sea Company. And this led to the South Sea bubble, because the stock in the South Sea Company grew and grew and grew and grew in value. Because John Blunt was giving money to people so that they would buy shares. Yeah? He'd pick on, you know, noteworthy individuals, lend them the money to buy shares, so it looked like they were really valuable and sought after, so everybody wanted them. When he issued new ones, more and more people got them. That's where the idea about market manipulation, making a market, all those kind of insider dealing offences, are all rooted in 1720. In France, the same thing was happening with the Mississippi Company. Money was being raised for a company that was going to trade in the Mississippi. Yeah. That happened in 1719, it crashed in France. Yeah. You had members of the royal family in France, you know, government ministers, everybody in the aristocracy wanted to be involved. Also, the kind of emerging middle class all wanted to be involved in this stuff, because you got rich quick. Same in London. None of these companies did anything. Yeah. They didn't trade, they'd never owned a ship, they'd never put a ship to sail. But what we'd managed to achieve was we convinced people, simply by the promise of future riches, that they should give up the need for gold and silver, they should give up reliable government debt, and instead they should speculate on companies. And so what this whole period does is it moves everyone away from value in precious metals into so-called fiat money, as in fiat, the car firm, where you just accept you're going to own a piece of paper, whether it's security or whether it's a banknote, that says you will be paid an amount of money. Now, today, you aren't allowed to go to the Bank of England and demand your £5 worth of gold and handing in your fiver, but up to a period of time, you could, in theory, have done that. Presented yourself at the Bank of England and said, I'd like my gold, please. And we stopped that a while ago. So we ended up with circulating money of that sort, and now, of course, we've moved even to paperless money. Okay? Moving to credit cards, moving to debit cards, moving to internet payments, electronic signatures. The whole sweep of the law on payment methods is always about trying to keep up with technology. How do we explain, in legal terms, how we're creating contracts in this basis, and what is it you own? That's why it's a great problem now about talking about owning bank accounts, because of course we're using tangible property metaphors all the time to try and explain things which are by definition electronic, intangible. So West Dutch Lands Mechanisms, and Lord Brown Wilkinson in that case, for example, has a subheading in his speech to try and explain the property flows in an interest rate swap transaction, which begins, subheading, a stolen bag of coins. He says, let's imagine the money that Westdeutsche had paid to Islington under an interest rate swap. Yeah. The absolute forefront of financial theory at the time. Let's imagine that's a bag of coins that are made of gold. So we're back in the 17th century at the latest. That is intrinsically worth what they claim they're worth on their face. And let's try and get those very coins back. So one of the big problems we've got with finance law, property law, contract law generally, is that the technology keeps developing and we constantly keep having to sweep along behind to try and catch up with it. Okay. So there's a huge amount of incredibly technical and tedious regulation dealing with electronic payments, for example, through the SWIFT payment system, through the BACS payment system, which is now just called BACS, Banking Automatic Collection Service, it was originally BACS. They all have their own rule books as to how payments can be made through them by banks and others. Okay? So there's a large amount of banking law practices to do with just the administration of those rule books day to day. Okay? We're focusing on some particular ideas and some particular cases and one particular thing under heading 4 about banks' duty to honour and liability for dishonouring cheques. So we're focusing on cheques. Cheques themselves in a few years are intended to become obsolete as well. Presumably the whole world is going to go entirely electronic. So these cases will become, you know, antique and to look back on. So there's a whole flow of history there about what finance or particularly banking law is trying to deal with and how it's always about law trying to catch up with technology and explain what's going on now. Okay. So we go back into antiquity again, the Bills of Exchange under heading 1 and the Bills of Exchange Act 1882. So this is the only even slight overlap with commercial law, I hope, this year. In commercial law, as you do in commercial law, I guess you're going to be doing letters of credit and all these kind of fund payment mechanisms, documentary credits and all that kind of stuff. I say that briefly in chapter 31 in the book. We're not doing that on this course, we're focusing on a particular thing to do with cheques. Okay? Now, we talked yesterday about the cheque clearing system. You write a cheque which is payable to the payee, and what happens in practice is the payee's bank comes to your bank and says, we want the money for this cheque, please. And then the question is whether or not your bank honours the cheque or not, whether or not it bounces. Yeah. Clearing mechanism today is that we have a clearer in the middle that actually clears all those cheques and clears all the amounts owed between all the various banks. In the old days, literally, you had a clerk would pitch up at the other party's bank with the cheques physically and ask for cash. So some of the early cases, what have I got on the handout? I suppose Mafani, back into Marzetti and Williams, these kind of early periods, you would literally have a clerk pitch up at the bank with the cheques in their hand and say, we want the cash for these, please. Fill up a big bag and have to carry all that money back to the first bank. Okay? Clearly, huge security problems, people getting mugged, robbed and all that kind of stuff. So hence the need to do this in a non-tangible form. So the Bills of Exchange Act recognises that we start to use cheques, yes? And we start just to settle cheques rather than having to carry money backwards and forwards. The Bills of Exchange Act 1882, a bill of exchange is an unconditional order in writing. Okay. Unconditional meaning there are no conditions on whether or not it can be paid on. It's got to be in writing, addressed by one person to another. Person, of course, meaning company as well as human being. Signed by the person giving it, requiring the person to whom it is addressed to pay on demand, or at a fixed or determinable future time, a sum certain, meaning an identified sum, as opposed to something that may fluctuate depending on market values, whatever else, to pay at a determinable future time, a sum certain in money, to or to the order of a specified person or to bearer. Okay. So, a cheque, obviously, fits into this under section 73. A cheque is a bill of exchange, says section 73 of the Bills of Exchange Act, drawn on a banker, payable on demand. Okay. So it's payable on you paying that, modern parlance, you pay the cheque into your bank account. Your bank then goes and makes the demand on the other bank on your behalf, effectively. Okay, in that sense, it's payable on demand. So back to section 3, subsection 1 briefly. It requires the person to whom it is addressed to pay on demand at a fixed or determined future, in a sum certain, or to be made to the order of a specified person. You can endorse cheques, or you could in the old days, by simply writing on the back of the cheque, this cheque is now endorsed to whoever it is you want to have it payable for instead. When I was a kid, this is a great feature of things on the telly. If you wanted to show someone was a rogue, they'd always be trying to get you to settle cheques, so they'd be offering you cheques instead of cash, and offering to write across the back of the cheque that it was now payable to you instead. Because now all cheques are crossed, you have those two lines in the middle of the chequebook, that means your cheque can't be endorsed to anybody else. Okay? So the fact that in the modern age, this is only a few years ago this was done, we have those two lines down a cheque. Or if you've got a very posh, old-fashioned chequebook indeed, you have to put the two lines on yourself and often write account payee only. Yeah, if you look at your chequebook, that probably says that as well, hopefully. That means that only the person you've put in as the payee is entitled to take the money off that cheque, and you can't endorse it over to anybody else. But some of the cases you'll look at mention endorsing cheques, and that's what that's about. Theoretically, that's possible unless they're crossed, the two lines put through. Or to bearer, it's perfectly possible for you to make out a cheque to be made out as a bearer cheque, like we talked yesterday in the Grosvenor Casino case. You can have a bearer cheque which operates effectively like a banknote. Yeah, whoever it is that's the bearer of that cheque is entitled to cash it. Or so everyone thought. And Grosvenor Casino obviously puts a limit on that. So section 73, except as otherwise provided in this part, the provisions of this Act applicable to a bill of exchange payable on demand apply to a cheque. Jolly good. Collection, the only reason I'm putting those cases on the list, I wonder why I haven't bothered to lift them out actually, they're comparatively recent. In commercial transactions, as opposed to the kind of transactions we will have, it's perfectly possible that banks will act through other agent banks, particularly if you're paying between different jurisdictions. You will often pick a respondent bank in the jurisdiction in which you want to make payment and get them to make the payment on your behalf. And so what these cases are about is that kind of relationship. Let's pick on the Middle Temple and Lloyds Bank, for example. Lloyds Bank were acting as agent for a Turkish bank in dealings with the Honourable Society of the Middle Temple. And Lloyds Bank had a cheque presented to it. It paid out on the cheque to the Turkish bank's detriment. However, Lloyds Bank was simply acting on the terms of his agency. It was doing what he'd been told to do at the start, even though the Turkish bank had wanted something done in their own brain differently later. Mr. Justice Ricks held that Lloyds Bank, because it was simply acting as an agent in collecting on this cheque and paying out on it, should be entitled to an indemnity from the Turkish bank. So there's a whiff of the kind of the old religions about whether you as a banker should be responsible if you pay out on a cheque for any loss or harm that causes to your own customer. Well, if you're simply acting in these commercial transactions as an agent for somebody else, as long as you're acting within the terms of your agency, you're perfectly entitled to pay out on the cheque. And the same idea comes up in Linklaters and HSBC, where HSBC was acting as agent for another bank called BPE. A thief stole one of Linklaters' cheques and presented it to payment fraudulently with BPE. And HSBC paid out. So BPE lost the money on the cheque to the thief, who then disappeared with it. Nevertheless, it was held that HSBC was entitled to an indemnity because it was simply acting within the terms of its agency as it was supposed to. It didn't bear any personal responsibilities for negligence in this regard because it was simply doing what it was told under its agency arrangement with BPE. And so Linklaters couldn't bring their action against HSBC as they wanted. So fairly straightforward stuff. As a banker, if you're acting within the terms of your agency, you know, as long as you act within the terms of your agency, then that seems to make you bulletproof. The bit that's really interesting for us, I would suggest, hint, is what is the bank's duty? We've talked yesterday with Macmillan and all those cases that one of the principal duties on a bank when a cheque is presented is that it's supposed to pay out on it. Yeah? You've got a chequebook from your bank. As long as you're in credit, as we talked about yesterday, if you write a cheque, your bank should honour it. Yeah? So in what circumstances can we say that a bank is entitled to dishonour your cheque? On what basis will a bank bear liability? Either for dishonouring your cheque or even for honouring it. Well, Lord Justice Diplock gives us the following principle in Mafani and Midland Bank from 1968. Well held. You're not paying enough attention. You're right. Nice person. Pay some attention, she won't drop it again. What the court must do, held Lord Justice Diplock, what the court must do is to look at all the circumstances at the time of the acts complained of and to ask itself, were those circumstances such as would cause a reasonable banker, possessed of such information about his customer as a reasonable banker would possess, to suspect that his customer was not the true owner of the cheque? So if you agree to pay out on a cheque from somebody's bank account, this is the principle that governs whether or not you as the bank will be liable to compensate that customer, to pay them back the amount of money they've paid out under the cheque. Okay. So someone's got a hold of one of my cheques and they have written out a cheque. The bank ordinarily should honour that cheque. Somebody else steals one of my cheques and they fill it out and pay it across and my bank honours that cheque. In what circumstances will the bank, when the cheque has been stolen from me or fraudulently filled out or forged or whatever it may be, in what circumstances will the bank be entitled, if it pays out under that cheque, to compensate me, give me my money back? You have to look at all the circumstances at the time of the acts complained of and ask, were those circumstances as would cause a reasonable banker? So first thing, what would a reasonable banker do? Would a reasonable banker, possessed of such information about his customer as a reasonable banker would possess? Which makes us need to ask the question, what kind of information do we expect a reasonable banker would possess? And that's clearly going to shift over time. This is 1968. Yeah. Some of us, in fact all of us in this room, I would suggest, probably weren't born when this case was decided. That includes me, thank you. Yeah, all right. So things have changed, yes? You know, electronic payment systems now, we talked yesterday about, software banks have got and everything else, what should they be able to spot? Back in the old days when bankers knew all their customers because they didn't have very many customers, you'd be expected to know more about a bank's goings on. Yeah. That someone is dealing with a bookmaker or not, for example. Whereas now, in the era of mass banking, everyone's expected to have bank accounts, even to get their pensions. How much information will the bank have about you, other than things it might be able to spot electronically? I think it's an interesting question, though. What do we expect banks to know in the modern environment about their customers? Yeah. You're probably going to know more about large corporate customers, because the bank will probably have more of a relationship with them. Yeah. Citibank's dealing with IBM, for example. You'd know quite a lot about how IBM functions, Citibank. Would they know about the likes of you and I as an ordinary customer? Probably not, other than things they've got held electronically or things that might occur to them from their software. Yeah. He doesn't usually gamble in Nevada. You know, I thought he lived in West London. You know, that kind of stuff. How do they know whether you've gone on a holiday or not? You know, because my guess is when you go away, you probably don't tell your bank. You know. Leave no milk needed today and I'm away. You know. Can you please go in and feed my cat, bank manager? What information would a reasonable banker possess? I mean, this just gives you, in problem answering, a chance just to discuss what do you think? You know, in an era of mass banking, information age, electronic age, the internet and everything else, you know, what kind of information would we expect a bank to have? Remember, there is also money laundering that a bank is supposed to be alert to suspicious transactions and warn the authorities. So another aspect of this age of internet banking is that banks are supposed to be watching out for those kind of suspicious transactions. So maybe we do expect them to be on the front foot at some level. It's very difficult to know because this is really just the last few years that the banking has changed in this way, the electronic banking and everything else. So back in 1968, this principle, how does it work? This is why reasonable is such a great word to keep using in the common law, because it just lets the courts look at the circumstances at the time. There's a great old cartoon, in those static newspaper cartoons, I can't remember where I saw it, one of the old legal rags a million years ago, where you have Moses coming down off the mountain with 11 commandments, yeah? And commandment 11 that he's holding in his hand, that you can see most clearly, visibly, and everyone at the bottom of the mountain can see, says, thou shalt act reasonably. Yeah? A couple of the guys at the bottom of the mountain say, the lawyers are going to love that one, yeah? It's just this common law term that we use, reasonable, reasonable, reasonable. The common law uses it all the time. Equity tends to talk about conscionable, sometimes talks about fair, but the common law term, and we don't know what to call it, is just say reasonable. The banker's term, I suppose, the banking regulation, is suitable. When we looked at COBS, we talked a lot about suitability and so on and so forth. Everyone's got their kind of blanket expression. It's a very English thing as well, because Americans like to try and list every possible scenario. Rather than use general words, they like to try and imagine everything that could possibly happen and list them all, which is why their statutes are huge, enormous, great things. Their regulations go on for pages and pages. Elizabeth Warren last night talking about huge SEC regulations. They are vast, because they try and imagine everything that could go wrong, instead of just saying, you know, you have to act suitably, you know, you're liable if it's unsuitable. So either you do one, where you try and imagine everything that can happen, or you go the other way and try and use a general word and hope the judges get it right case to case. Very different philosophy. So we have to try and work out, you know, the circumstances as would cause a reasonable banker possessed of such information about his customers a reasonable banker would possess. So what kind of information would a reasonable banker possess? We'll discuss. And that would cause him to suspect that his customer was not the true owner of the cheque. Yeah, it causes you to suspect. So I guess it's got to be that there's something about the transaction that would put you on notice, something about the circumstances that would put you on notice. And maybe that's where we feed into the bankers using that kind of software that watches your payments going through your account, particularly credit cards. You know, where's your credit card being used? Buys a horrible number of legal textbooks on Amazon every autumn, and then suddenly, hang on, Gambling in Nevada, are we sure that's them? You know. But that raises suspicion. Comparatively recently, Architects of Wine Limited against Barclays Bank. That's the daftest name, is it? Architects of Wine. Auditors of Fun. I mean, you can just go on, good. Lawyers of Desire. What does it mean, Architects of Wine? Architects of Wine and Barclays Bank. The court should be wary of hindsight. After something's gone horribly wrong, it's easy to look back and say, oh, you shouldn't have done that. So the court should be wary of hindsight, or of imposing on a bank the role of an amateur detective. Yeah. Sounds like fun if you did, though, wouldn't it? Far more fun to work in a bank if you did become an amateur detective. You get a deer stalker and a magnifying glass. Or a Columbo raincoat, perhaps. In other words, what the case law is saying, 2007, ironically the same year as the money laundering regulations, 2007, if you recall, but this is post-COBS and all this other stuff as well, there is no positive obligation in the common law on a banker to search things out. There's no positive duty on you to discover these kind of things. So that fits in, I would suggest, with McMillan and Bishopsgate, Mr. Justice Millett, when we did Knowing Receipt, talking about account officers are not detectives, quote unquote. It's almost exactly the same gag. Yeah? No positive obligation on you. Yeah? Polypeck and Nadir, no positive obligations on you. Women in Armitage and Nurse, that's Lord Justice Millett again, why I mentioned it. Again, this idea that, you know, there are no positive obligations on you. Interesting that the case law is always reluctant to impose obligations on people, like bankers, that they haven't voluntarily assumed. And yet the regulation seems to be going the other way. So, again, it's a theme we've mentioned a million times as we've gone through the year. You know, to what extent can we expect substantive law and regulation to overlap and come together? And what are some of the circumstances in which they're clearly very separate? Nevertheless. Okay, jolly good. So not very well reported, Architects of Wine. You can find it on Bailey. Otherwise, it's just in the Business Law Reports Digest. Are the Business Law Reports, you know, people do the Weekly Law Reports and whatever else. Now they've got something called the Business Law Reports, which is quite a good summary, and they have a digest at the back of the reports, and it was in amongst all there. I must admit, I spotted it originally thinking, Architects of Wine? And I thought, oh, banking law. Yeah, it was definitely in that order. 4.2. Yes, we can see how that kind of lends itself also to problem asking. You know, what do you expect of a reasonable banker? What do you think? Yes. Very general. This isn't an area that's peopled with case law in the way that, you know, mainstream contract law is, or mainstream tort law, or mainstream property law. And so it gives you a lot of scope to ask what do you think is reasonable in the circumstances. 4.2. The year 1830. Yeah. The place London. 9:30 in the morning. There is £69 in the customer's bank account. The bank opens its doors. Business begins. Not bustling business. It's 1830. They wouldn't have very many customers. They probably know their customers quite well. So it's not like, you know, Barclays on campus here or Lloyd's Bank on the Strand or one of those where there's lots of people going in and out all the time. You're moving to Lloyd's Bank on the Strand, beautiful building, beautiful old building, beautiful interior, very much 19th century interior, so I can imagine this kind of stuff going on there. Old-fashioned, huge banking ledgers, okay? We keep the accounts in ledgers, yes? We have to get the appropriate ledger down for this particular customer's accounts. 11 o'clock, a customer comes in. Be someone well-to-do because they have a bank account. By definition, they're well-to-do. Bless you. £40 is deposited in cash in the bank. 11 o'clock in the morning. Customer puts the lavender gloves back on, leaves the bank. It's not till 4 o'clock in the afternoon that presumably a languid, bored bank clerk pulls the ledger down and makes a record in that customer's account
that £40 was deposited in cash at 11 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Presumably a long luncheon. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, however, the customer had come back into the bank with a cheque made out to cash for £87. So had presented a cheque for £87 at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The bank cashier, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, had got the ledger down and said, sorry, can't settle this cheque. You don't have enough money in your account. You've only got £69 in your account. But I was in here at 11 o'clock this morning, 4 hours ago, and deposited an amount of £40. What on earth have you been doing? You've only got 3 customers. At least 2 of them. What on earth is going on? This went to court as to whether or not the bank owed a liability to have honoured this cheque presented at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was heard by a jury. Back in the day, a lot more cases were heard by juries than are now. Pretty much today, of course, it's criminal trials and defamation. But back in the day, there were different tiers of courts depending on your status in society. And you were judged by a jury of your peers. Partly where the expression comes from, I suppose. The jury held that this was appalling. This is an unreasonable delay, and therefore the bank was responsible for compensating this customer for having an unreasonable delay in paying this money into the account. So we seem to have some general obligation on a bank not to unreasonably dishonour your cheques. I split an infinitive there and I apologise. So, for example, in Evans and London and Provincial Bank, we see the general principle that a bank is liable to compensate a customer for any loss that's caused by wrongfully repudiating a cheque. If the customer's in credit, going back to Macmillan and all those cases, if the customer's in credit, the bank must honour the cheque. I suppose the same must be true now in the common law in relation to electronic payment instructions. If there's enough money in your account, they should honour your payment instruction. Okay. I suggest, I don't know. Evans and London Provincial Bank, we have a woman who presented a cheque to pay for groceries. This is why we have a small claims court now. But in 1917, it clearly bothered her enormously. It bothered the Times enough to report it. Wrongfully, her bank repudiated the cheque, dishonoured it, failed to pay out on the cheque. She had enough money, the bank should have paid out on it. It was held that she was entitled to compensation, but on the facts she could demonstrate no loss. She got away with her groceries, after all. She just had the embarrassment of the grocer saying, terribly sorry, missus, but your cheques haven't cleared. All terribly embarrassing, I'm sure, but no actual loss. Couldn't even show defamation, which is a bit of a shame. So you get the general principle there that the bank is liable to you to compensate you if it fails to satisfy, fails to pay out, dishonours your cheques. Westminster Bank and Hilton, Rolled Products makes a similar point. Here we have a bank which countermands a cheque. Countermand meaning a cheque's been written out, and then you, for example, might ring your bank and say, well, I've written a cheque for this amount, but I want you to stop it. Yeah. That's known as a countermand. Now, the bank countermanded the cheque because the customer had told it to. The customer then realised it had countermanded the wrong cheque and contacted the bank, but the bank nevertheless countermanded the original cheque following its instructions. That had already gone through into the belly of the beast, and there wasn't time to stop it. So the customer sued the bank, saying you've dishonoured that cheque, you've made that cheque bounce by countermanding it. It was held, not entirely surprisingly, that the bank shouldn't be liable because it was simply following its customer's instructions. So yes, there's a liability, but that will clearly depend on the circumstances. There's a liability for the bank if it bounces a cheque, if it dishonours one of your cheques, to use the technical expression. But that obviously will depend on the circumstances, and I think Westminster Bank and Hilton sounds fairly straightforward to me.
Okay, I think that's all we need from banking. Sheila wants to give you forms to fill in about, you know, what you think of the course.
We timed that perfectly.
Jolly good. While you're doing that, I just want to shove us on just a little bit ahead to banking regulation, just to give you an overview as to what we're going to start off with next time and what we're doing for that topic, okay? The one thing with filling those forms in is to remember that Wank has only got one N. Page 104, banking regulations, to give you an overview of what we're going to do. Don't fight. There are two bits. We're going to talk about banking regulation as it's actually organised now. But what we're not doing, this isn't now a problem answering area. Okay, in fact, nothing that we're doing from now to the end of the course is problem answering. We're kind of thinking and essay writing and everything else. So we're going to spend some time studying the way the system is organised at the minute. And that's going to be next week. And then the week after, we'll be looking at the financial crisis generally. Okay. So the North Society event next Thursday at 6:30. I'm going to start into the very deep economic backgrounds to all of that, so we're not going to overlap those two too much. With banking regulation, just if you want to get into the reading to explain how it all fits together, because it's a bit confusing. Page 104, there's international regulatory initiatives. All of our banking regulation begins at the international level with the Basel II Accord, if you're an American. The Committee on Banking Supervision at the Bank for International Settlements sets out in Basel II, which you can find on the internet, the whole report's available on there, the three pillars, if this sounds like European Union law, it probably is, the three pillars that govern banking regulation globally. So that's where we're going to look for current big picture policy on how we regulate banks around the world. There are then, on page 105, a lot of European Union regulations, which implement basically the Basel Committee proposals, and then they're implemented in the UK. So we're going to focus on how the international stuff works, because a lot of our criticism about the banking crisis is going to be at that international level. Then we're going to look at what the UK is doing. So I have, thanks to Emma, put up, I hope now on WebCT, Blackboard, whatever it's called today, some stuff from my practitioner edition of the Law of Finance, governing the Banking Act 2009. Which hadn't been passed when the textbook was written. So I put a bunch of text up there on Blackboard for you, and that I'll talk about on Friday in the lecture, which is the UK response to the banking crisis. So give us an idea of legally how that's supposed to work as well, what we do with banking collapses in the future. And then, so that's 107 onwards, you get all the bullet points for that. Again, we're thinking about this in terms of essay writing, but I've given you a lot of stuff on that. And then we're going to move into talking about the banking crisis proper. So page 111, I've got suggestions for things. I think some of them in the library. But I'll hopefully do a lot of podcasting before we get to those lectures. And obviously, what you're thinking about, I would suggest, is, you know, the banking crisis discussed. What happened? Is any of this regulatory structure of any use? What caused the banking regulation? What should we do in the future? So essay titles are going to be as broad as possible to let you take your own particular focus and interest on the crisis. So I think it's useful to understand the legal underpinnings we've got. You can criticise them if you want. We've looked at those documentaries, The Love of Money, those sessions we're doing on Thursday nights, give you a lot of ideas, those of you who have been in for those. There's a huge amount of potential reading. The internet is obviously full of stuff as well. I'm encouraging you to kind of take your own approaches to that. So you're going to have your last seminar with Magda, will be on that, to kicking all that stuff around. And I'm going to make a load of surgery sessions available as well in the last 2 weeks of term, if you want to come and talk to me principally about your essays. I'm going to encourage you to come in gangs if you want to talk about things you've been reading and how you put it together and that kind of stuff. That's also your last seminar. And then the last thing we're going to cover, just in lectures, and again I'll make some time available if people want to talk to me about it, is financial derivatives. Because I think it's part of your education, you need to know about derivatives, although unfair to test you because it's so technical.
But the specimen exam paper has a question on what are the shortcomings of how we deal with financial derivatives out there in the world today. Yeah. So that's what we're really going to be thinking about, with looking at derivatives, teaching you what are they, how do they work, and also what are some of the shortcomings in the way in which we regulate them, document them, and how did that also help the financial crisis up.
Okay, so that's really what we're doing for the rest of the course, kind of big picture thinking ideas, okay? So you've got forms, please, it'd be lovely if you could fill them in, and Sheila wants them back. Idea before you go? Yeah? Very good. Okay, so we've got 5 minutes to do that, please. Thank you very much. We do look at them, they get scrutinised, and everyone wants to know what you think, you know, so what we do with the course in the future. Whether we do it again. Hi. Let me stop.